Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
Good morning. Now, I speak with an accent, and I am told that people like that, and they listen to you more carefully because you sound different. So I'm kind of hoping that that works to my advantage again this morning. I often find that it does when I'm speaking to a North American audience. So enjoy the English accent. Let's be honest. We are all suckers for a really good love story. In fact, even grown men have been known to cry at movies like The Holiday, Luke Knight. There is something magical and wonderful when everything turns out right. The guy gets the girl gets the guy, and they live happily ever after. But what makes a good love story truly great is when the couple have to work. You know, when they face adversity, when they face challenges, and they really have to work to make this all turn out well. We want them to overcome adversity, and we want them to work for the joy that they're about to receive. I recently performed my first wedding ceremony, and it was just an incredible experience, wonderful, joyous experience. And the couple that I was marrying had faced challenges of their own. She's studying to be a doctor in Grenada, and he to be a chiropractor in Portland, Oregon. And so they had all the challenges of long distance. Any of you that have done long distance, you know what that's like, you know. There's all the misunderstandings because you can't read each other's body language as you're talking on the phone. There's not being able to give each other that hug for encouragement or that pat on the back. Not to mention the long distance phone bills, can you imagine? So their wedding day was all the sweeter because they had overcome the challenges that they'd faced together. The story of Ruth gives us all the twists and turns of a well-written love story, except that it's true, and it's not the fantasy of some lonely spinster. Seriously. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of the context. Ruth's story occurs in the time of the judges. Now, this was a period of disobedience, idolatry, and violence, and the Israelites did not fully follow God's instructions. When they went into the promised land, they actually failed to drive out the inhabitants of the land. And they got into this pattern of repeatedly sinning against God. So God would allow judgment. In ways of foreign oppressors or sometimes natural disasters such as famine. So over this 325-year period, the Israelites would turn away from God, suffer judgment. They'd then cry out for mercy, and God would rise up a judge from among them who would deliver them, and then there would be a period of peace. But as we all know, human beings were people of complacency, and so complacency would set in, and the cycle would begin all over again. So this is the era in which we find Ruth. Other notable characters that you may have heard of that would have lived during this 325-year period are Deborah, Gideon, Samson, and Samuel, who was the last judge of Israel. That's just to kind of help you put it a little bit into context so you can place Ruth where she was at. Now, the book was written for the people of Israel. We do know that. The author is unknown, but some people believe it was Samuel. When it was written is also highly debated, so I'm not even going to guess at that one. And the reason for it being written is also debated. Some say that it was to show how three people remained strong in character and true to God even when everything around them was falling to pieces. Others believe it was written to defend the royal line of King David by showing that his Moabite great-grandmother was, she embodied true covenant faithfulness. But whatever the reason, This book, this story, has lots for us to learn today. Ruth was an absolutely incredible woman. So let's start at the beginning, and I'd like you to turn to your Bibles. Go to Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. If you don't have your Bible with you, it's okay, because guess what? There's PowerPoint, and it should be right up there on the screen. Look at that. Modern technology, isn't it wonderful? In the days when judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and his two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. So the story begins with Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their sons. And to escape the famine in Judah, he decides to take his family and settle in Moab. Now, it's kind of interesting that he would choose Moab of all places, because during the time of the judges, the Moabites oppressed Israel. In fact, they were actually adversaries of the Israelites, and there was hostility between the two nations. And that hostility actually went all the way back to Abraham and Lot. You see, Moabites were a descendant of Lot, and their beginnings were not exactly good ones. I don't know if you recall the story of how they all came about, but I'm just going to give you a quick debrief. When Lot and his family left Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, God was pouring down the sulfur and the burning and all that stuff. They fled, and his wife turned back, looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. So it was just Lot and his two daughters, and they escaped into the hill country. Now, his daughters got a little bit worried, because you know what? All the men were dead. So they were going, there's going to be no husbands. What are we going to do? And so they devised a plan, and they decided to get their father drunk on wine. And then they slept with him, and they got pregnant. And so Moab was Lot's oldest daughter's son by way of incest. So the Moabites don't exactly have the greatest heritage. They come from an incestuous relationship. Let's get back to the story. So we don't know how long, but once in Moab, Elimelech dies. And so here we have Naomi and her two sons. She's left a widow, and she's left with two sons. And that's not always a good thing. Now, the next interesting thing is that Naomi allows her sons to marry Moabite women. And they marry girls called Orpah and Ruth. Now, again, this is a little bit of a surprise, because friendly relations with the Moabites was discouraged. Let's go to Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 and 4. No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants for 10 generations may be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. These nations did not welcome you with food and water when you came out of Egypt. Instead, they hired Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor in distant Aram. Let's just say Aram. I can't get my mouth around that one. So the Moabites were not allowed to worship at the tabernacle. They were considered less than and not good enough. Yet Naomi allows her sons to marry two Moabite women. The family lived in Moab for about 10 years. And then lo and behold, the two boys die, leaving all three women widows. Now, in this culture, that meant that these women were not only defenseless, but they were also destitute. You see, they didn't have men to protect them or provide for them. It's ironic that Elimelech left Bethlehem to escape the famine and possible death, only for him and his sons to die while they were in Moab. Now, Naomi heard that the famine in Judah was over, and so she decided to return to Bethlehem. The three women began to prepare, and as they hit the road, Naomi started to tell them, you know what, it's not a good idea for you girls to come with me. Why don't you go home, go back to your mothers, there they'll, you know, you can marry again, you can have a family, you can have children. You see, Naomi knew that it was one thing for Israelite men to marry Moabite women when they were in Moab, but for Israelite men to marry Moabites in Israel, that was not going to happen. And so she knew that their chances of getting married and having families was going to be really slim if they went with her to Judah. Initially, both of these women protested, and they were like, no, we're going to come with you. We're going to stay with you. We're not going to leave you. But eventually, after some persuasion, Orpah conceded, and she left Naomi and Ruth, and she went home. However, Ruth insisted that she remain with her mother-in-law. And she goes even further than that by not only aligning herself with Naomi, but also with her people and her God. Ruth chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 says, "But Ruth replied, 'Don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us.'" Wow. "May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us." We might not fully grasp the magnitude of this, but Ruth would likely face racism, misunderstanding. She could be mistreated, abused. Going back there, like, that was what she was facing, let alone being very, very far from her family. I mean, today we've got Skype and we've got internet and we've got, you know, phones. We can keep in touch with people across the other side of the world. But back then, she would never see her family again. This journey would not be an easy journey. Well, that didn't come out too well, did it? Well, you can see the kingdom of Moab, right? So they'd have to go north, get across, and then come down. Can you see where Jerusalem is? Bethlehem's just a little bit further down than Jerusalem. So this was a long journey, even if they had donkeys to ride on. We're not talking about, you know, a five-hour flight. This is a long journey. And the other thing to think about is they didn't have any protection because there were no men with them. So this was a serious thing. So Ruth's insistence on going with Naomi was both courageous and brave. She was taking a huge risk. But clearly Ruth felt that this was the right thing to do. Can you think of a time when you've had to be courageous and brave, where you've taken a risk because you just knew it was the right thing to do? It might not be quite as dramatic as what Ruth did, but it was a risk all the same. I can remember when David and I decided to emigrate to Canada. It was a risk, okay? It was exciting, and we thought it was great, and we knew it was the right thing to do, but it was a risk. And it took quite a bit of courage and bravery. He was 26, and I was 25, and we had a two-year-old in tow. So we sold our home. We had to sell all of our possessions. David gave up his job. We left family. All of his family is in England, his mom and his dad and his three siblings. His sister had two sons at that point in time. We had grandmothers there. My dad was there. My aunt and my cousins were there. And then friends that we'd had our whole lives. And so we were packing it all up and leaving it. And I had family here, so it wasn't quite as bad as it is for some people who emigrate, but it was still risky. And I can remember that first night. Do you remember the first night? And we're lying in bed. We're staying at my brother's place, and we just kind of lay there, and we looked at each other, and we said, "What have we done?" Seriously. You know, it's like, while you're getting all ready, and all the excitement and everything, but then when you actually get there, it suddenly hits you. What have we done? We had no jobs, no home. Even our belongings weren't with us because, you know, it takes like 6 weeks for them to get from the UK out to Canada because they have to go all around the houses. And so, you know, what have we done? But we knew that it was right. So although we were terrified, we knew that what we'd done was right. And obviously, time has proved that it was the right decision, but it still took courage at that time. So these two women continued on their journey together, and they arrived in Bethlehem at the time of the barley harvest. Now, we need to bear in mind that widows had no one to support them. So this meant that destitution and starvation basically awaited them. However, Ruth took it upon herself to go and work in the fields, picking up leftover grain. And that's called gleaning. Now, the Israelite law demanded that the corners of the fields not be harvested and any grain that was dropped be left, so that the poor could pick them up and use it for food. Now, just by chance, Ruth found herself gleaning in the field of a man named Boaz. And it turns out that Boaz was from exactly the same clan as Elimelech, Ruth's dead father-in-law. The plot thickens. Boaz notices Ruth. Why does he notice her? Because she's a foreigner. She's going to stand out. She's an ethnic minority. She's a visible minority. So he goes to his foreman and he says, who is that woman? Where is she from? What is she doing? And so the foreman tells Boaz everything about Ruth. And so Boaz goes to her and he says to her, I want you to stay in this field. Please don't go and glean anywhere else. You're more than welcome to stay in this field. You'll be safe here. You will not be mistreated. I've told my men to leave you alone. So please stay here for the duration of the harvest. Now, Boaz knew that if she worked somewhere else, she'd run the risk of being abused, beaten, or even raped. As a widow and a foreigner, she had no protection from would-be predators. And so Boaz was looking out for her because he felt that it was the right thing to do. Ruth was shocked by his kindness. She asked him, why have I found favor with you? I'm just a foreigner. And this is what Boaz said. Ruth chapter 2, verses 10 to 12. Yes, I know, Boaz replied, but I also know about everything you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. I have heard how you left your father and mother and your own land to live here among complete strangers. May the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, reward you fully for what you have done. You see, Boaz was impressed by the loyalty and faithfulness of this young woman. And a little later, he invited her to join the other harvesters at the mealtime. And he also gave her some roasted grain. Okay. So can you picture this? Here is this young woman. She's destitute and she's poor. And the owner, no less, the owner of the field that she's gleaning in has taken a personal interest in her. He's made sure that she's safe. He's made sure that she's able to get water. He's made sure that she's had something to eat. Now, Scripture doesn't tell us whether he's handsome or not. But does he really need to be? Seriously, ladies. Okay, guys, take note. You don't have to be handsome. But if you're gentle and you're kind, you're going to win a woman's heart. This is a true love story in the making. Now, Ruth gets home, and picture yourself as Naomi. She wants to know everything. Question, 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 question. Whose field were you in? Did you find out who I was? Like, she wanted to know everything. When Naomi discovered that it was Boaz's field that Ruth had been gleaning in, her little mind began to work overtime, and she began to devise a plan. You see, Boaz was not just any relative. He was a close relative of Naomi's dead husband, Elimelech. Ruth returned to Boaz's field and she worked there each day. And she worked through the barley and the wheat harvest. Then Naomi decided to share with Ruth her plan, but not all of it. She reminded her that Boaz was their kingdom redeemer and she gave Ruth instructions to follow. This is what she said. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley at the threshing floor. Now do as I tell you. Take a bath. I'm guessing they didn't take baths very often back then, okay? Take a bath and put on perfume. And dress in your nicest clothes. Wow. Then go to the threshing floor. Ooh. But don't let Boaz see you until he has finished eating and drinking. Be sure to notice where he lies down. Why do you think she said that? You know why? Because it would have been pitch black. There's no streetlights, right? Pitch black. Be sure to see where he lies down. And then go and uncover his feet and lie down there. He will tell you what to do. Okay, now, side note. There was something in Israel called a kinsman redeemer. Okay, so I'm just going to explain a little bit about kinsman redeemer. If a man died leaving no heir, then the nearest male relative, which could be a brother or a cousin or a second cousin thrice removed, but the nearest male relative was to buy the family property, marry his widow, and then their first son would carry on the dead husband's name and the property. This was a way of protecting property in Israel to make sure a family name was kept. Okay, that's how they did it. So the process did not usually occur in the way that Naomi was advocating. And scripture doesn't tell us whether or not Ruth knew about this custom. However, what we do know is that Ruth did not question Naomi's instructions. She simply trusted she had her best interests at heart, and she did exactly as she was told. Okay, now, ladies, I'm just going to talk to you for a minute. Can you imagine your mother-in-law telling you to go to the spa for the day? Wouldn't that be nice if she paid? Go to the spa for the day, get yourself all dolled up. Do you know what dolled up means? Okay, good. Just checking. Get yourself all dolled up and then go to the party on your own. Okay. Look out for the guy that she's chosen for you. And when he gets a little bit tipsy and falls asleep, you go and lie at his feet. Guys, can you imagine your mother doing that and saying that to your wife? Like, seriously? I mean, it's pretty shocking, even in this day and age. But then, it was scandalous. It wasn't unusual Jewish custom for a servant or a slave to go and lay at their master's feet. What was unusual was that Ruth was a female, and she was making herself incredibly, incredibly vulnerable. When Boaz woke to find Ruth at his feet, he asked who she was. Can you imagine? Who are you? She told him to spread the edge of the corner of his garment over her, as he was a kinsman redeemer. So Boaz responded again with great kindness, making every effort possible to protect Ruth's reputation. You see, a woman on the threshing floor was a social taboo. We don't really have any social taboos for women anymore, but back then, women just did not go on the threshing floor. I guess it was a bit of a party place. And so her being there could have absolutely ruined her reputation. In fact, if he had chosen to expose her, her chances of ever being redeemed would have been thrashed. Like, they would have just been gone. And so just as we think all of this is going to work out well, there's a twist to the plot. Guess what? It's one of them lovely twists, right? Boaz isn't the nearest male relative. There's actually another guy. And so he instructs her to lay there until early the next morning, and then tells her to leave before anyone else is awake. And he promised to go to the city, to settle the matter. Either the closest male relative would redeem her, or he himself would, as he was the next in line. Now, this came as a big shock to Ruth, because they thought that Boaz was the closest male relative. So this is one of those love story twists that gets us sitting on the edge of our seats at the movies. You know, oh no, what's going to happen? You know, she's falling in love with him. We're falling in love with the idea of them being together forever. And what about this other guy? What if he's mean? What if he just wants the land and he's going to mistreat her because she's a foreigner? And, you know, your head starts going. But Boaz is true to his word. He goes to the city gates. He calls the elders together. And he asks the closest male relative if he would buy Elimelech's land. Well, this guy jumps all over it. Yeah, I'll buy it. I'll buy it. Yeah, I'm in. But you have to marry Mahlon's widow. I don't want her. Sorry, don't want her. He had his own property to protect, and so he didn't want the two estates getting mingled, and so he declined, which was great. That's good news for us, right? Because we want a happy ending, don't we? And so the hero of the story stepped in. Boaz agreed that he would be the kinsman redeemer. So Ruth was to have her happy ever after, a reward to her faithfulness to her mother-in-law. So Boaz married Ruth, and he redeemed both her and Naomi from a life of poverty. He was a man of standing, a man of character and integrity. the true Mr. Darcy of his day. The guys probably don't get that, but the women all did. Ruth became pregnant, and she gave birth to a son named Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. And just like Rahab, Ruth the Moabitess is mentioned in Matthew chapter 1 in the genealogy of Christ. A very unlikely candidate, Ruth would never have dreamed that her great-grandson would be the most famous king of Israel, a man after God's own heart. So what can we learn from the life of Ruth specifically today? As Leanne a few weeks ago said about Rahab, we wouldn't have chosen the likes of her to be in the lineage of King David, let alone Jesus the Messiah. Neither would we have chosen Ruth. She was a Moabite, a detestable foreigner, not even allowed to worship in the temple. She was an enemy of Israel, an outsider, an idolater. She worshipped false gods. In fact, Moabites even sacrificed their children in the fire to their god Chemosh. Ruth was from a bad lot. What did God see that we don't? He saw Ruth's heart. She was a woman who was willing to trust. She was prepared to leave everything she knew to follow Naomi back to Bethlehem, a place and a people that she knew very little about. She trusted Naomi to teach her the customs and the ways of the Jewish people. She trusted Naomi's God to provide for them. She also trusted Boaz, and she took him at his word. She trusted that he would not take advantage of her, and she lay at his feet all night, totally unprotected. She trusted Boaz when he told her that he would go to the city gate and sort out her and Naomi's future. She did not doubt that he was a man of his word. In addition, Ruth was a woman of obedience. When Naomi instructed her to go to the threshing floor, even though it was incredibly risky, she obeyed. She trusted Naomi's advice and she followed through on the plan. She could have insisted on a younger man, but rather she listened to her mother-in-law and did as was suggested. Ruth was also faithful. She was faithful to Naomi. She stuck by her. She followed her to Bethlehem. She was faithful to care for her and provide for her until such time as they were redeemed by Boaz. Most importantly, Ruth had faith in God. She aligned herself with him when she said, "Your God will be my God." Ruth gave everything to follow God. She gave up her homeland, her family, her idols, her gods, her safety. She risked all to be obedient. But what a reward. Because of her trust, because of her obedience, because of her faith, she is an ancestor of Jesus Christ, the kinsman redeemer of all people, Jew and Gentile alike. What can we learn about ourselves from this story? God can use anyone, regardless of their background. Leanne told us that Rahab didn't let what she had done in the past, her life of a prostitute, prevent her from aligning herself with God, with the God of Israel. She encouraged us not to let our own sinful past disqualify us from being used by God. Interestingly enough, Boaz is a descendant of Rahab. So if Rahab had not trusted God, then Boaz would not have been born. Ruth's people were the result of an incestuous relationship. Later, they had refused to help the Israelites and instead had tried to curse them. During more recent times, they had oppressed the nation of Israel, and they worshipped the god Chemosh and sacrificed their children in the fire to him. Their practices were detestable. Ruth had every reason to believe that she would be disqualified, but we see from her story quite clearly that she wasn't. Like Rahab, she aligned herself with the God of Israel, and he accepted her just as she was. Has there ever been a time in your life when you felt embarrassed or ashamed of your heritage or your family background? Something that you personally had nothing to do with, but it affects how others perceive you and treat you. I'm going to get a little vulnerable. When I was about 8 years old, I made the biggest mistake of my life at that time. You see, in school, we were studying about gypsies, Romanies. And I thought it was really cool. I loved hearing all about them and their history and where they came from and what they did and how they lived. And one of my favorite things was drawing the gypsy caravans. I was actually quite a good artist when I was little. I don't know what happened. It sort of disappeared on me. But anyway, that's the gypsy. So I got home and I was really excited to tell my mum about what I was learning. And my mum, bless her heart, decided to tell me that my great-great-great-grandmother on my father's side was a gypsy. And I thought, this is cool. And I couldn't wait to go to school and tell my friends. You all know what happened, don't you? So I tell my best friend, and she laughed. She didn't just laugh. She decided to go and tell all my classmates. And they laughed as well. And then they decided to jeer at me. And they started to chant, gypsy, 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 gypsy. And I just died inside. You see, unbeknownst to me, gypsies were kind of, well, they weren't really well thought of back then. And they were considered sort of thieves and robbers and vagabonds and good-for-nothings and very, very superstitious. In fact, their women would make these good luck charms and bits of heather, and they'd go door to door and they'd sell these things to the housewives. And if the housewives wouldn't buy it, they would curse them. Yeah, they'd actually jinx them and tell them that they were cursed. So the gypsies didn't really have a good reputation. And so here was I at 8 years old, kind of associated now with them. And I really began to feel this stigma. And I began to feel like I was on the outside and that I no longer belonged. It was not very nice. How easily can we take an experience like that and internalize it and begin to disqualify ourselves from opportunities, any opportunities, let alone opportunities that God might have for us? I distinctly felt like a less than, a second-class citizen during that brief period of my life. As I grew up, I discovered far worse skeletons in my family's closet than gypsy blood running through my veins. Really good reasons why God would not want to use me. I'm sure you can think of a few of your own skeletons in your family's closet. Have you ever found yourself saying, God can't use me? Look at where I come from. Look at my family background. No one would give me a chance. If they knew about my dad or my mom, if they knew about my brother, if they knew about my grandma, my uncle, whoever, they'd never let me get involved. They wouldn't trust me. Even I wouldn't trust me. Or do you play that deadly game called comparison? You look around the sanctuary and you spot all those who are far more qualified than you are. That person has such incredible Christian heritage. God, surely you want to use them over me. Their dad's a pastor. Their grandmother's a missionary. Their great-grandfather pioneered a church. I want you to take those thoughts or anything like them, and I want you to crumple them up like a piece of paper, and I want you to throw them as far away from yourself as you possibly can. Why? Because our family background is of no consequence to God. He's not concerned about the stock we come from. Rather, he's interested in our hearts. This is wonderful news, okay? It's wonderful news. God used a Moabite test to be the great-grandmother of King David, to be in the lineage of Christ. Why? To show us that he doesn't disqualify any of us based on our family of origin. What does this story tell us about God? It tells us about his loving kindness and his interest in the details of our lives, no matter where we have come from. The Hebrew word for this is hesed, and it is found all the way through this story. Simply put, God cares. More importantly, it tells us about his grace. None of us are worthy. It isn't really about us at all. It's actually about God and his immeasurable grace. He doesn't actually need any of us to do anything. He could do it all. He is all-powerful, almighty God, the creator of all things. With one word, he spoke this planet into being. And yet, he chooses to invite us into his story. He graciously wants us to be a part of what he is doing. When we look at all the unlikely characters that he's used in the Bible, we can see that it wasn't about them at all either. It was about him graciously choosing them to be a part of what he was doing in the world. We cannot earn it. We cannot be good enough, smart enough, rich enough, anything enough. It's by his grace that we are saved, made clean, and used. So where are you this morning? Are you open and ready to respond with trust and obey in faith when God asks you to step into his story? Or are you sitting on the outside, not sure that you belong, not sure that you're ready, not sure that you're good enough, smart enough, holy enough, whatever enough? Wherever you are on your journey today, I want to encourage you. Through the story of Ruth, God reveals to us that, number one, he searches the heart. He looks at our willingness to trust, obey, and have faith in him. Secondly, no one is disqualified by their family background or heritage. We're not judged by our ancestors' beliefs, words, or actions. Our ethnicity, our family background is of no interest to God because we're all his children. And thirdly, it's about his grace, his wonderful, incredible, abundant grace. He graciously invites us to take part in his story. So if we ask, who me, and we respond as Ruth did with trust, obedience, and faith, as Luke told us last week, we then have to ask the question, who them? Because as Luke said, the gospel is for all nations, for all people, and this has to inform the way that we live. Thank you.